welcome to Season 13, Episode 4 of the Ubuntu Podcast. Welcome. I'm Alan, and with me this week is my good friend, Martin. Hello, Martin. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. And Mark, how are you?
Am I not your good friend?
No, it was all part of one sentence.
Oh.
My good friend, Martin, and Mark.
Ah, okay, we are one and the same now. Okay, hello, I'm all right, thank you very much.
Good.
That's awkward.
I might have to edit in, and my good friend Mark, into the show. Well, I'll just leave that in there, and we'll put that in, yeah.
Good.
What have you been up to, Mark?
Well, I've been playing board games, but not, as you might expect, in person with people. Although you might expect that these days. But what I've been doing is playing board games on a computer.
Have you been using Tabletop Simulator by any chance?
I haven't. I have in the past, but I mean, Tabletop Simulator is good up to a point, but basically it's a physics simulator and you have all sorts of stuff and people mess around and you either have to... You have a choice between some games of questionable licensing and quality and sort of making it up yourself a lot of the time. So what I've been using instead is a website called Board Game Arena. And this is a site where you can play in your browser various board games which are properly licensed and quite good. And there's no additional simulation around it to make it look like you're actually sitting around a table and people messing around and flicking dice everywhere. You just have the game and it sort of makes the mechanics of playing it easier and signals when you're playing and what you've got to do each turn. So it's quite easy for people who either aren't so familiar with a particular game or aren't so familiar with playing it online. It makes it quite easy for you to bring people in and get stuff going. So,
okay. So are you playing with remote participants, I imagine?
I am. So I have some people who I work with. We have an occasional lunchtime board gaming group. And now that we're all working remotely, I decided that it would be good to try and keep that going and play some games with them.
What do you do in terms of keeping in touch while you're playing the game? So... Do you have like a Skype call running or something? Or
yes, not? So we use Skype and Microsoft Teams for conversations anyway. So we tend to just do that. There is also a feature if you're a premium member of Board Game Arena, which I would recommend because their servers are struggling.
I can imagine.
They could do with having some more money thrown at them. They do actually have a sort of WebRTC based. Chat video and an audio chat thing if you're a premium member, which you can use, but at the moment we've just run that as a separate thing via Skype.
And which games have you been playing?
There is a game called Six Nimpt or something like that. I don't think it's an English word, but basically you're placing cards and trying your luck against what other people are going to place and trying to not have to take lots of cards and score lots of points. It makes a lot more sense when you're playing it than when I try and describe it. Mm-hmm. But that's a good one, especially the way that it's presented, because it does the complicated working out who's won for you rather than you having to look at everyone's cards and work it out yourself. And the other one I've been playing is Carcassonne, which is a classic tile placing, map building, resource stealing game, which, yeah, again, works quite well, guides you where to put things. Because for new players, it can be a bit tricky to work out where things go and what you do with your pieces. I've had a few games of those and they work pretty well. And I'm sort of gradually exploring which ones work well and which ones I enjoy and who I'm going to be playing them with. But I would highly recommend anyone who enjoys a bit of board gaming and wants to keep doing it when you can't go and see people in person, boardgamearena.com. And the premium accounts are quite cheap as well. It's something like £4 a month or £20 for a year, so worth it.
Let's get on with the show.
Hello.
So there's been another resurgence of Linux phones. That is, phones that run something other than Android, basically.
Yes.
And we wanted to have a chat about the future of these devices. Do they have a future? Where is their market? Who's going to buy these things? And will they continue to survive? This was your idea, wasn't it, Mark?
It was. So, yeah, I'd noticed you mentioned a phone which I'd seen sort of knocking about a bit called the Vola phone, which is a phone which is being... it's crowdfunded, is it?
Yes.
Yes. And their initial thing was that it's going to be running an Android open source project based OS, so a sort of Google free Android. But then they also they raised a lot more than they were originally going for, and so they've said that they're going to have other operating systems available as a stretch goal, which I think now includes Ubuntu Touch. And alongside that, we also had rumbling on for a while the Librem 5, which is still in development and has shipped some initial versions. And they've got their Pure OS, is it, that they're running on that? And we've also got the PinePhone now, which is available for pre-order with Ubuntu Touch, but they're also talking about all sorts of other things that, that can run on it. As a sort of, you know, developer ARM-based handset. And it struck me as interesting that, you know, there's just another round of you know, manufacturers who are seriously looking at alternatives to Android and iOS in various Linux-based guises, which, you know, we sort of, we had this a while ago, they all kind of then went away, didn't really get much traction. But something, for some reason, has made these people say, now's the time for us to give this another go. And I'm curious to see where it all goes this time.
Yeah, it's difficult. For personally speaking, it's difficult for me because I had a hand in Ubuntu Touch and, you know, worked at Canonical, was hired by Canonical to work on that team. And so I have a bit of a jaded perspective on this whole thing. And I'm sure there are people who worked on devices before that that feel similarly about, you know, creating Linux first devices, who feel similarly jaded. So we're probably the worst people to talk to about this kind of stuff because we've seen this stuff fail in the past. And I think many of us who worked on this stuff in the past can't see a path to success in the future if people keep doing the same thing that we all did in the past and didn't succeed then. So, and I should also say, I haven't actually tried a Librem 5. I've never seen or touched a PinePhone, and I don't have a Volaphone. So we're somewhat speculating based on their PR and the feedback we've seen from other people in the community.
Are these phones all... so, for example, the Librem 5 is very much orientated towards a privacy-conscious audience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do these other phones target that market, or are they more general purpose in what they're looking to achieve?
To some degree, yes. The Vola is touted as a security-focused device. Mm. So they're certainly going after that market. I think there's certainly... a number of devices that are targeting people who probably have in the back of their mind Edward Snowden style revelations and thoughts that people are spying on them and all these current problems that people see with the proprietary operating systems. And I'm including Android in that because they feel like these big corporations are spying them and the little guy won't be doing that. And if it's all open source and open hardware, then they're less likely to be doing that, less likely to get away with doing that.
So is that the thing that's changed? It's not so much the phones, it's the potential audience that can only be targeted with an open hardware, open source phone.
That's certainly a thing that's changed since we did it. That wasn't the selling point of Ubuntu Touch. It wasn't a thing that we talked about. It was a byproduct. Like, you know, you don't have all these Google sensors in your
or Google attached sensors or Apple attached sensors in your device. And so it was a byproduct, but it wasn't the main selling point of the devices. So yeah, maybe that's the big thing, but that whole thing, that whole security and privacy shtick has been around for a little while now, and none of these yet have massively taken off. And I don't know if we're just too early or are they too late?
Hmm.
Or when people, mass audience, looks for a device like this, will Samsung or Lenovo have a privacy first device that will just, they'll be able to produce more of cheaper?
Yeah, maybe Samsung will create a device that has a switch in it to turn the camera and the microphone off and turn the radios off. Because that's one of the things that both of those phones, the Librem 5 and the PinePhone, both have physical switches. The Librem has it on the outside, the two big clunky switches on the outside. And the PinePhone, you take the back cover off and there are little dip switches inside that you can use to turn on and off the hardware features that people would consider are the privacy invasion parts of the device, the microphone, the radios, the camera.
Mm-hmm. So one other thing which has changed since the sort of previous generation is that the free software platforms to run on these phones have come along quite a bit. So, you know, when the Ubuntu phones were first released, it was basically if you wanted something, you know, if you wanted a Linux operating system which was really good on touchscreens, that was basically it. There was Ubuntu Touch. Nothing else had really been designed with that in mind. But nowadays, GNOME apps have pivoted towards a more mobile-friendly style, moving away from menus, moving towards a top bar with icons and the controls of the app there. There's UbiPorts have kept Ubuntu Touch going and continue to develop that. There's also Plasma Mobile, which is the KDE effort to make a sort of mobile-focused suite of apps and interfaces. And then there's other things. There's Selfish OS, there's Postmarket OS, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on around this. So does any of this have the potential to make a difference with these new devices? Is the platform more important than the device itself?
I think you're right in that they've all moved on a bit and they've all got better. They've all got a little bit faster. I mean, it helps that the hardware gets faster over the generations. But yeah, I think they've all moved on a bit. And I know the GNOME stuff has been helped by the work that Purism have done for the Librem 5 with their LibHandy library that helps app developers to make their app almost, shall we say, convergent.
Yeah.
So that it works on a mobile device and desktop larger screen form factors as well. So yeah, I think I worry a little bit that we're only talking about the most recent generations like UbiPorts, Ubuntu Touch and Yola, but we haven't mentioned that there are generations before this as well, like the Nokia N900, MAMO, Moblin, and all these other things that Intel and Nokia did all back in the day. They all had a go at this, and these were giant companies with huge budgets. And they still failed to get market adoption for things like that. Nokia N900 was a fabulous device. It was stupendously expensive. But it was lovely. And it had mainstream marketing and big promo video. And I don't know what numbers it sold in, but it didn't reach enough mass market appeal. It was killed pretty soon after it was created. So I don't know that any of the others are doing anything that those didn't do two generations previously that would make them succeed where they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember my first foray into mobile devices and Linux was a project called Familia. Did you ever see this? And I installed Familia, which was GNOME-based, on a Compaq iPack 5950 using a Compaq flash card. And you had to sort of purge the Windows CE firmware off the device. You had to jump through some pretty extreme hoops to make it happen. And as you can imagine, it was early. It was impressive it ran at all, but it was early days and, you know, it just wasn't geared up for that sort of thing. And I feel like a lot of these things have been interesting projects, but they have been ostensibly projects rather than products. And I don't think that the product is there for a mainstream audience. So maybe these projects need to target the interested people that would follow those projects rather than think about it as a product.
Right. And I think that's where Google have succeeded, by taking Linux and building a platform on top of it and making Android, and taking Linux and building a platform on top of it and making Chrome OS. They've succeeded very well by productizing Linux and various parts of the Linux desktop stack, right? Not necessarily all the bits that we would necessarily argue are the bits that are important. And I think you're right. I think some of these are failing to productize the software and hardware combination they have. But I also think, even if they did, it would still be a niche audience, just like Linux on the desktop is. I think what we're failing to appreciate is, as we mentioned in the previous episode from the Steam survey, Linux is a tiny, tiny part of the desktop market. Like, if you're looking at the desktop, Linux is something in the region of 1% to 2% total desktop. And the phone part that we're talking about now is an even smaller niche of people who are willing to accept, like, people who run Linux are willing to accept some foibles and lack of functionality. Otherwise, they wouldn't run Linux, right? But, well, in exchange for software freedom, flexibility, configurability, not giving all their data to the man, et cetera, et cetera, right? And the people who are going to do that on a mobile device is an even smaller niche. So if you think of 1% of all the desktops, if you aim for 1% of all the mobiles, that's still a tremendous number of devices. I don't think it'll ever get to the point where it's competing with Android and Apple, but it might still get to the point where there are people who want it, and enough to keep it a sustainable industry, which Linux desktops are sustainable. Yeah. Like, there are already multiple companies making money off the Linux desktop. Maybe that's all that's needed for the phone. It doesn't need mass adoption.
I agree. I had a similar conversation with some of the members of the UB Ports project at UbuCon in October last year. And I was saying, you know, don't try and compete with Android and iOS. You know, serve your niche well. You know, you look at it, not even the tier one vendors that are shipping laptops, but the smaller sort of, you know, boutique OEMs like Entroware and Slimbook, they are money-making businesses that are shipping Linux distros on hardware to a niche set of users, but they're able to make a living out of it. And I think that, you know, there is enough of a market and enough of an interest to sustain, you know, mobile phone manufacturing with Linux operating systems. But just try and serve that audience well. Mm. Don't try and take on the big boys, because they've got billions of dollars at their disposal. It's just, you know, never going to happen.
I think the interesting thing for me is the way PinePhone are doing it, in that they're doing just the hardware and they're letting the community deal with the software side, because they know there are multiple operating systems that are possible. It's like buying a bare bones NUC, or, you know, some other bare bones desktop PC with no OS on it, because they know there's operating systems you will get hold of and you'll put on it. It's not a lot different than that. It's buying a piece of computing hardware, commodity computing hardware, and putting your own operating system on it. And I think that's actually not a bad way to go. If they do ship them with an operating system, then they can potentially give a small slice of money to that open source project, and they can use that to drive development forward of their operating system. And so it's a symbiotic relationship between the hardware vendor and the software vendor, much like Android used to be. Used to be third parties who would make the hardware and Google would make the OS. And now Google make their own hardware because they don't like the way other people make the hardware, which has kind of screwed that relationship slightly. But I think that's a way to go, the way PinePhone are doing it.
I think that's also an illustration of what I was just saying about serving their niche audience well. You know, mobile phone nerds are quite comfortable with the idea of downloading their own firmware and flashing it on their device. That's what that group of people do. So PinePhone have built a whole product around that. Well, it's not a product so much at the moment. It built a device that exploits that sort of adventurous customer.
So we should probably try and get one of these devices and try it out and see what we think, shouldn't we?
That would be good. One of the problems with this, even getting one of these devices, you're going to make that natural comparison to the existing Android and iOS. And the big place that they all fall down is with apps.
Yeah.
They just don't have the app ecosystem. Now, some would argue you don't need all those apps. You know, you don't need all those games. Like, just stop playing games on your mobile phone, right? Use your Nintendo Switch for that, or use some other device for that. But even if you did that, if you just excluded all the games and you only talked about applications, then you've got your base core applications of clock, calendar, calculator, web browser, note-taking app. You know, there's like a dozen applications that you will use all day, every day, right? And then there's the hundreds of other apps that you won't have. But the thing about these is these devices all try and encourage you to become a developer, an active participant. They all want you to be part of the ecosystem. They don't necessarily want you to just be Joe consumer buying a thing and using the app. I think that's where this might differentiate, is the users become the developers of the platform and developers of apps that go on the platform. And I think that's where they may succeed, is there, it's a platform by developers for developers.
So I've done the maths. there are three phones: the Librem 5, the PinePhone, and the Volaphone, and there are three of us.
Gosh!
So that would be a convenient. I mean, if we could get one of each of those to each one of each of us in some sort of tombola type exercise, maybe we could compare and contrast and try and be as blank canvas as possible. Maybe we could pass said phones between the three of us and each come up with a comprehensive view of each of the devices.
I don't know. I think that would take too long. I think just each one of us have one device. I think that's okay. Each one review one. We don't tend to pass laptops around, so I think the same thing would go with the phone. Yeah. We each have one, which means I would like to Bagsy, not the Librem 5. Thanks very much.
I can't afford the Librem 5.
Unlucky, Mark.
Uh-oh.
So... I'd be interested to hear what our audience think of this.
Especially if you have one of these devices and you've been, you know, using it and what you're running on it and what you do with it. Do you still talk to all your friends and family on it? Do you use it for development? Do you use it for something completely different?
Do you carry another phone around with you to fill the app gap or something? So yes, if you're using one of these, do let us know how you're using it and did it meet your expectations, and where did it not, or where did it exceed?
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it's time for a command line love. Now, this one was ninja'd into the notes by you, Martin. You added this. Where did this come from?
I did. This actually came from our colleague Ian Lane. We were joining a video conference the other day, and he was not making any sounds as he was talking, and he typed into the chat this command to restore his audio.
He should have typed it into a terminal. It would have been way more successful. Typing it in chat.
It was good that he did type it into the chat window as well. So this is a systemd incantation that restarts Pulse Audio. And it turns out this is the correct and modern way to restart Pulse Audio, such that it restarts, but all of your, you know, audio devices reconnect to the socket and carry on working. unlike the old way of doing it, which I'm not going to explain. Now, I could read out all of these letters and numbers in this command. I won't. Come to the UbuntuPodcast.org website and you can see what the command is, but it uses systemd to restart Pulse Audio in the user session.
There's always room for more feedback. On our website, each episode has its own comments, so post yours on UbuntuPodcast.org.
And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. Thanks, everyone, for writing in. We've had messages from Jim Sanderson, Torin Doyle, Jason, Thayer, all left comments on our website. Thank you very much for your kind words. But first up, Dustin Nisbet-Jones emailed us, show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And he says, I was wondering if you would consider discussing the new AMD mobile processors, the Ryzen 4000 series, and what users can expect the Ubuntu experience will be like at launch. I'm a very happy Ubuntu LTS user, and I'm quite keen to upgrade my old trusty ThinkPad 430, oh, not ThinkPad chat, for something shiny and new. Okay. So, there are quite a few people at Canonical who are also very interested in this new breed of CPU and are all thinking about getting ThinkPads that sport Ryzen 4000 series CPUs when they come on the market.
So given, they not exist yet?
They're just starting to exist, but not from Lenovo and ThinkPad just yet.
So what's exciting about a Ryzen 4000 series CPU?
They are lower cost than the Intel equivalents. They are lower power consumption, lower TDP, so lower thermal design as well. And they outperform the Intel CPUs. So I think it's Asus and Acer have released their initial laptops. And the batteries last longer. The CPUs outperform even the high-end parts from Intel, and the power consumption's lower and the heat produced is lower. So just better in every single way. I am sure there are enough people at Canonical and enough people at the OEMs that we support who are interested in making successes of these CPUs. Until we get our hands on some parts, we can't talk authoritatively about them, but we've got some colleagues of ours in Taipei with cupboards and cupboards of hardware, and they get sent all the good stuff. So I'll be sure to speak to them and get the inside skinny.
Matt Spader emailed us.
You asked about what kids are using for distance learning. My son, age 5, is using a combination of printed worksheets, his teacher's YouTube channel, and a mess of a website that runs on Microsoft SharePoint. It's awful and feels like it's out of the early 2000s. I installed Ubuntu on an extra laptop and run the site in Firefox using as much security as I can. One question for you, gents. At my work, we are in the process of getting security certification. I was shocked to discover that Windows 10 and macOS are the only listed desktop operating systems that fall under universal compliance. Ubuntu and Red Hat aren't listed. I found out the main reason for this is because there doesn't exist a way to remote lock and remote wipe Linux devices. But I know that's not totally true. Am I wrong?
I know nothing about certification. So, I mean, I think the dealio here is that those operating systems have built-in ways that are hard to circumvent in order to remote wipe. And it's a built-in feature. And I don't know of any distro that has a built-in feature that's hard to circumvent by the end user that would allow something, because someone could just steal your laptop and, you know, boot from a live USB key and disable the cron job or whatever it was on Linux. You know, would make the remote wipe happen. I may be wrong. If other people know more about how remote wipe works on Linux and if that is a possible thing, do let us know. But I don't know that such a thing exists.
It, like you say, it can be added after the fact. I know that we've set up Landscape to do this for customers in the past. But, you know, it's not the same solution. We do go after other security compliances though, like, you know, FIPS and stuff like that. So we're looking at that more from the server point of view rather than devices.
Dax Mickelson emailed us.
And he said, I wanted to show you my desktop as I took the default image of Focal, he's referring to Felicity and her wonderful laser eyes, and mirrored it. Then I put the different backgrounds on each model so they are having a showdown. So we've got two laserized Focal Fusas staring each other down. Brilliant.
Yes, I enjoyed that picture. Nathan Lee emailed us.
I have a very similar build to Mark's Steambox on my desktop PC, AMD Ryzen 5 2400G with a Radeon RX 590. Excellent choice. Overall, I love the performance. In theory, it's powerful enough for VR, which is really exciting if you ever want to get into that. I do experience a bug regularly, though, if I set games or benchmarks to their highest settings. I'm wondering if you have the same issue, where after a few minutes of play, the screen turns purple and green and freezes the computer. Could you try to replicate this? I can't say I've come across this at all. Even doing some of the things that Nathan suggested in his email, I've never seen anything like this. But I do remember seeing a few people when I was asking about buying modern AMD graphics cards in our Telegram channel saying that they had experienced similar sort of weirdness and freezing. And I can't remember what they said it was related to. I don't think it was the same card, though. It may have been earlier versions of the drivers. I think it was different cards. So no, I can't replicate this, but I've definitely heard of it from other people.
The first couple of things I would check is your cooling solution adequate for your CPU? And
certainly.
The other is, have you spec'd your PSU to be beefy enough to deliver the power to the CPU, the disks, the GPU and all the other pieces? So maybe do some sums, work that out.
That was a problem that I had when I was initially building this. I tried using an existing power supply I had, which wasn't nearly powerful enough. So when it started booting, the fans on the graphics card would come on and then nothing else would happen. So yes, definitely check your power supply.
Jim Kelly emailed us.
I have a ThinkPad T410 that I have been running Ubuntu on for some time. Unless my memory has gone all wonky, there used to be a setting to turn off the display after X number of minutes. In 1910, there isn't such a setting. There's just a setting to blank the screen. Is my memory wonking, or did this setting disappear in 1910?
Martin shrugs.
I don't know. I have no idea. Come on, it's a ThinkPad. It's a ThinkPad question, Alan. I was relying on
you. No, it's not. It's a GNOME desktop question, Martin, head of the desktop team. So the settings in GNOME Shell are dim screen when inactive, blank screen after a number of minutes, and that's all I see as well. And I'm on 2004, so I assume that's much the same. I don't see anything to actually turn the display off. I wonder if blank screen actually means turn the display off.
May do. I tell you what, we'll do some research, or better yet, maybe someone who's listening to this could do some research and let us know.
Yes, especially if you're still running 1804, is there a setting to turn the display off rather than blank it?
Finally, Bill, who is awesome, emailed us.
A ThinkPad corner would be a wonderful segment to add to the show.
Please don't encourage him.
I feel like we've had a couple of episodes worth of ThinkPad corner.
It could be a separate podcast, Alan.
And on that bombshell, that's the end of your feedback. Thank you all for sending it in. And that's all for episode 4. Thank you all for listening. It's been very enjoyable to be chatting with both Mark and Martin. Next week, we'll be back with more news and community news. And it'll be even closer to the 2004 release. So we'll be preparing for that awesome day at the end of April. Do send us your feedback, if you have any, to show@ubuntupodcast.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, @UbuntuPodcast on Twitter. Thank you all for listening. See you all next time.